Good afternoon. I'm Rhonda Fineman, and this is the Healthy Options program right here on WERU Community Radio. Today, for our annual tick discussion, Lyme disease and other tick-borne disease conversation, we turn again to Dr. Beatrice Santier, pediatrician, internist, and our resident tick expert. For more than two decades, Dr. Santier has lectured on Lyme disease and related tick-borne disorders throughout Maine and nationally to both professional and community groups. She's an active member of the Vector-Borne Disease Work Group from the Maine CDC, as well as a member of the International Lyme and Associated Diseases Society. In 2022, Dr. Santier also had served on the Federal Tick-Borne Disease Working Group, Access to Care and Education Subcommittee. Welcome back to Healthy Options, Dr. Beatrice Santier, and it's so good to speak with you again.
It's always good to be with you, Rhonda.
Well, you know, we've been doing this for a while, and sadly, tick-borne illnesses and this conversation is still relevant and appropriate. So,
thank you for continuing to have it, because it really is. An ounce of prevention really makes a difference.
So for those who have not listened to this conversation before, that's what we really want to talk about, that it's best not to get the bite, and it's best not to have to deal with the things that we're going to be talking about. So we can, where to begin? Should we, at the beginning is always a good spot.
Well, I guess most of what we'll talk about today is probably Lyme disease. So just starting there, and why not do the numbers? You know, the numbers are up. Over 2,900 cases of Lyme disease reported by Maine CDC last year. When I looked at national numbers, they are also up. Over 60,000 confirmed and probable cases nationally. That would have been in 22. They don't have 23's numbers yet for the nation. But what I wanted to mention to your listeners is the way in which Lyme disease is being counted has changed. And so it's not perfectly clear what these higher numbers mean, because they're being tracked in a different way. In the state of Maine, where we were having many, many cases of disease, like 100 cases per 100,000 population, it became onerous to keep track in the way that we had been. And so it has been changed, along with the change definition. In areas where the incidence of Lyme disease is very high, they are no longer tracking cases by the rash or other presenting symptoms. It's completely based on laboratory testing. So it changes the amount of manpower that has to be devoted to the surveillance activity. In areas where it is not a high incidence disease, it's being tracked in the same familiar way. So old methodology, if you would. But I think we don't know yet what that's going to mean for what the numbers are doing. But the numbers are higher, and I don't think it's a surprise. They're just about not quite double what they were before we were tracking in this way. It's probably a third again as high. And that sort of fits, because we knew that for every case we were investigating two cases. So it fits with what was being done. I think it also makes me have to remind folks that in a very careful study done using insurance records and office visit records, looking nationally, it was determined that there were something more like not 40,000 cases a year, but 476,000 cases a year. And so this is probably going to give us something closer. What we lose, unfortunately, in tracking this way is some of the clinical information that we were getting with the other method. We keeping track of how many people had a rash, for example. And we know that although the rash is considered the diagnosis itself, if you have an erythema migrans rash, you have Lyme disease. We know that not everyone gets one. And so it matters, or maybe not everyone remembers. It could be more than one issue, but so the way we're gathering numbers has changed. And so yeah. It'll be interesting to see how that shakes out.
Well, that's what I was going to say. Isn't this mostly a clinical diagnosis? And if we're looking at blood tests, which are not reliable, then what are we really seeing? So, we'll just leave that as the great question in terms of our listeners and in their lives and what we're really right. talking about. I think it's important to know that now that rash is many people have seen maybe there's a bite and then there's a big red
circle. Yeah, circle or it really it's a filled in circle mostly. And thanks for that, because although we talk about the rash as a bullseye rash, that's kind of the famous classical description of this rash, a bullseye rash. In fact, most commonly, people do not get that rash. The rash they get is a uniformly red, expanding rash. And so it can be round, it can be oval, it can have some very unusual shapes. In a really elegant study that was done quite a while ago, they determined that only about 9% of rashes that were, in fact, cultured and proven to be from Lyme disease, only about 9% actually had that bullseye appearance.
Right.
So if there's no central clearing, it's okay. It might still be.
And it could be in another area of the body, not at the site of the bite.
It may not be at the site of the bite. I think most of the time it probably is. But what we know is that most people who get Lyme disease do not recall seeing a tick. So if you're waiting to have a tick and then the rash, you're going to be in a very small number of the people who actually do get Lyme disease. I believe it's like fewer than 15 to 30% of people saw the tick. And in Maine, the last time we had data for the occurrence of a rash in definite Lyme disease, it was under 50%. Now, nationally, the numbers look more like around 70%. But
really,
the important part is not everyone gets a rash.
So if you've had a tick bite and you don't have a rash, it doesn't mean you haven't gotten infected by this bacteria.
Exactly. We'll talk about what to do if you have a known tick bite. But if you develop symptoms of any form, and usually we talk about flu-like symptoms, so fever, headache, fatigue, sore throat, achiness, those kinds of symptoms, there are a lot of things that give summer flu. But Lyme disease is one of the important ones, and the other kind of tick-associated infections.
So we are talking, in this day and age, you also have to test for COVID and make sure that you're not harboring other kinds of viruses and bacteria. But sadly, that goes without saying right now.
Yeah.
So when we talk about Lyme, we're talking about a specific tick, but I'm remembering and recalling that there are other newer ticks that have entered the great state of Maine. And maybe we could talk about what people are looking for or may encounter in their adventures out in the world.
Well, we have 15 tick species in Maine. People are most likely to encounter only about three of them. So the black-legged tick, also called the deer tick, Ixodes scapularis, that is the tick that carries and transmits Lyme disease. The second tick that people encounter commonly is the dog tick, Dermacentor variabilis. Yeah, Americanum. Dermacentor. and it's a larger tick. It also can carry infections like Rocky Mountain spotted fever and Ehrlichia species. Looking at the data from the tick lab at the University of Maine, they haven't found them to carry anything yet. They are now testing for things, but we haven't found infection. So that's good. And the third common tick is probably the woodchuck tick, which looks just like the deer tick. So to the person encountering it, you may not notice a difference. And importantly, that tick carries Powassan virus. So yeah, not fun. I'll tell you about a fourth tick that we are watching. It is not considered established in the state at this point, but it's the Lone Star tick, or Amblyomma americanum. And the Lone Star tick is small, like so many ticks that cause trouble, either uniformly dark or with a bright white spot in the middle of its back, thus the Lone Star. And it is capable of transmitting several infections. It's known for STARI, the Southern Tick-Associated Rash Illness that looks just like Lyme disease, but we can't prove what bacteria is involved or what agent is involved, so STARI. Also known to transmit Ehrlichia chaffeensis and Ehrlichia ewangi. And the only reason this is consequential is we have been tracking cases of Ehrlichia chaffeensis, and they're kind of steady state, but they're higher than they used to be. And so, you know, there have been, I think the data is around 95 Amblyomma americanum ticks have been sent in and identified at the tick lab over time. Only about 19 of those were among people who had no travel outside of the state. So they are being encountered here, we think, not in great numbers. The probably most concerning infection or condition that's been associated with this tick is called alpha-gal syndrome. It's a red meat allergy, and it's a weird one because it's not an immediate allergic reaction that you have to eating red meat. It's kind of delayed, which makes it fairly difficult to get, you know, identified and diagnosed. And it can be a fairly serious illness. We are now watching for alpha-gal syndrome diagnoses in the state. Last year, there were 8 cases identified. Now, were there more than that? Probably. But we know about 8 through the data that's collected at CDC. The year before, there were 5. The year before, there were 2. It sort of is wandering up in the same way that the infections with this E. chaffeensis is wandering sort of gradually up. So it's becoming a more important tick for us, even though it's not yet considered endemic here.
So people can't digest or they get ill if they've had red meat?
Yeah, they become very ill with anaphylaxis kinds of things.
Oh my goodness. And that means you can't breathe.
Can't breathe, swollen hives. It can be quite serious. And what I have discovered by investigating around this is it's not just red meat that you know you're eating. There, alpha-gal is a sugar, actually. And it is in some things that you might not expect. There have been medications, IV medications delivered that have an alpha-gal component that have, of course, caused trouble. Not in our state, but it can happen. And that makes it something that we really have to be quite aware of in the world. So if, as a person, you turn up with just weird symptoms of kind of allergy, and, you know, it's 4 hours after your meal or longer, so you might not associate it with what you were eating, but tell people that tell your healthcare provider. I always tell folks, tell them all of your symptoms, even the ones you think are too weird to tell anybody about, because it helps us to put together what's going on.
If you've just joined us, you are tuned to WERU Community Radio, and this is the Healthy Options Program. I'm Rhonda Feynman, and we're discussing ticks and tick-borne illnesses with our tick expert, Dr. Beatrice Santier. We're going over all the possibilities of what you can get when you get a little critter bite. Oh my goodness. Yeah, it's the creepy crawly show, folks. So we're going to get into that even a little bit more. Now, what is Ehrlichia? I've heard of that. And what is anaplasmosis?
They are white blood cell parasites, basically. They're a family of bacteria that infect white blood cells. It's funny, the black-legged tick can carry a number of different kinds of infections. It carries the Lyme bacteria, Borrelia burgdorferi. It can carry Babesia microti and some other Babesia species, which are red blood cell parasites and infect the red blood cells. It can carry anaplasmosis, which is in sort of a rickettsia relative. And when I think rickettsia, I think about spotted fever, but it's not. But anaplasmosis can be extremely serious, extremely problematic. It's one of the diagnoses that if you think it, you should treat it and figure out if it was it later. So from a clinical standpoint, it can be very, very serious.
Is that a bacteria as well, or a virus, or a parasite?
It's another white blood cell invader. So yeah, it's a bacteria, but the rickettsias are really amazing little guys. And in their family, they have, we don't want to celebrate them. I'm sorry. Let's move on.
they're like parasites, or yeah.
Functionally. They parasitize people, you know, functionally you get sick with an infector. It's a bacterial infection.
Oh, it is. Okay.
The other is Borrelia miyamotoi, which is another kind of Lyme disease look alike. It has been reclassified as hard tick relapsing fever illness. If you have infection with miyamotoi, it can look a lot like Lyme disease, but will never test positive for Lyme. So you have to have suspicion about it. And of course, the other thing, there are viruses that can be transmitted by black-legged ticks. The important one that I want to mention for sure is Powassan virus. And the reason I want to mention that is twofold. First, although it can be a very unimportant illness, I suppose. We don't know how many people get this virus that we never know about it. But in those people we do find out about it in, they have a serious neurologic infection and it can be fatal. And the consequential piece of knowing that it travels in that tick is to know that it can be transmitted in like 10 to 15 minutes.
Oh my.
From the tick bite. So for me, if you don't really think keeping ticks off of you matters, this one should change your mind about that. I hope it will influence your decision-making about keeping ticks off, because 10 to 15 minutes is pretty quick.
Wow. Let's just let that sink in. And what about Lyme disease in general? There's so many different conversations. Some, you know, is it 24 hours? Is it 36 hours? Is it 3 days? Or is it 15 minutes? You know, or
yes. A lot of conversation about it. In general, here's my generalization. The longer the tick is attached, the more likely it is to transmit infection if it's carrying infection. To put an hour time on it is probably not that helpful. I would note that over the years, and I've been around this for a long time, we have gone from saying, well, it has to be attached 72 hours to transmit, to it has to be attached 48 hours. It has to be attached 36 hours. I think we're down to 24 hours now. Some of the earliest studies, I found this paper that I've read a million times and read it again and found something in it that of the four cases of Lyme disease that were identified as transmitted by a tick attachment, three of them were after 72 hours, and one of them was after 14 hours. So can it happen in less than 24 hours? Yes. Is that the commonest? No. More often it takes longer. People are poor judges of how long a tick has been attached generally. And I'm not, you know, ragging on them. Just we are. We don't know.
And you also don't know the tick you haven't seen.
Precisely that. So that's for an identified tick. We kind of can gather the infection rate for the identified tick, but we know that most people never see the tick that gave them Lyme disease. So.
Well, that brings us right into the idea of how to avoid getting a tick on you. And so let's talk about that. But and then we can talk about if you do if these things fail, how do you remove a tick, or and how what should we do to minimize infection?
Well, precisely that. So we call it, first you have to be aware that there might be ticks in the area you're going into. And yes, tall grass is an issue. The edge of the woods is a particularly black-legged tick-friendly area, brushy areas, leaf litter, wood piles, brick walls, places where rodents will tend to hang out, because white-footed mice particularly, but many other rodent species are hosts to these ticks. And so where they tend to be, you have to be mindful. How you dress matters. Long pants, long sleeves creates a barrier. Tuck your shirt into your pants into your socks. Most of the data tells us people don't like to do that.
It's hot out. If you're in the summer, it's hot out and you want to wear shorts. Yeah. And if you're in the winter, you're not thinking about it, but they're there, and we'll talk about that. But
anyway. Well, yeah. It's been a year-round phenomenon, certainly this year. But permethrin-treated clothing. So permethrin is a chemical. It's chrysanthemum-derived. Permethrin-treated clothing have been studied and found to decrease tick attachments. They thought about the summer, and the group out of Rhode Island did a study in which they showed that if you treated sneakers and socks, because ticks crawl up generally, if you treat your sneakers and your socks, 73 times fewer tick attachments. That's pretty good. So permethrin, treat your clothing. And especially at least shoes and socks. If you do it yourself, it will last for several washes. If you have it done by a company that professionally does this, it will last 70 washes.
70
washes. So it's a worthwhile investment if you can do that. In addition to that, use EPA registered repellents. I know everyone wants me to tell them it's okay to go ahead and use geranium oil, and it's okay to go ahead and use whatever one's favorite essential oil is. And I can't, because mostly they have not been studied. So if you have used them and found that they work for you, I can't speak to that. I can only tell you that the ones that have been studied are oil of lemon eucalyptus, which has been found to be effective. In general, it needs to be applied more frequently than some other formulations. There is a website that where the EPA tells you what you can use and how long it'll last. And I apologize, I don't think I included that one in the resources.
We'll find it.
Yeah. So oil of lemon eucalyptus has been studied and found to work. Something called Newt Ketone, which I don't know if it's quite yet made it to market, has been found to work. Undecanone, which is a wild tomato derivative, has been found to work. But the ones that have been well studied are still DEET, more than 23%, probably less than 50%. You're not getting any greater benefit.
You don't need 100%, and it's got, you know, it's not the thing. We do have to wash this off a lot.
Wash it off. The key to using any of these safely is wash it off after the adventure. Even the essential oils, from my standpoint, it's all chemicals. Some of them naturally occurring, some of them man-made. Wash it off. Just use sense. The only significant troubles with DEET products over the years have been identified in prolonged usage, repeated applications over a lengthy period of time without washing it off. Simple thinker, wash it off. Picaridin is another. At 20%, picaridin is an excellent model of protection, and probably in some studies has been shown to be superior to DEET. So picaridin is good. The other one is IR3535. I think the studied percentage was 15. It's usually marketed at 20%, found to be very effective. So all of these have good data. They're registered. They've been looked at for both safety and efficacy.
Now that goes on your skin.
Yeah, on your skin.
And Permethrin is what is on your clothing.
Fabric. Right. Yeah. Now there have been studies where they've used, you know, DEET on clothing, and it has some efficacy, but not as effective as it is on skin. And the reason is the way that repellents work is they combine with your body oils and your body heat to create a vapor layer that these arthropods don't like. And the good news is the things that are effective for ticks are also effective against mosquitoes. So they have, that would be a whole nother show. Because they have their whole set of potential harm that they can cause. So, but
okay. So we have the I love that the what is it, the IR 35, yeah, it's like a science fiction designation. Yeah.
Yeah, I don't know if they ever gave it a better name. I haven't seen it.
But no, I haven't either. But these things are available. I've seen them all in Maine.
Yeah, often at
my travels.
Yeah, and not at specialty places. I mean, you can find them almost everywhere at this point. So it's good news. And then, of course, the key when you return from your adventure, whether that adventure was cleaning up the brush in the backyard or doing some gardening, take a shower within 2 hours of your adventure. And that's really just the better tick check. Do a careful tick check. And that means looking and feeling all over the body for a new bump. And remember the hot spots. By that, I just mean places on the body that might have very good blood flow, which will be attractive to a tick. So behind the ears, around the neck, in the armpits, under the breasts, at the waist, in the groin, behind the knees, at the ankles. I think that the studies for 2023 by UMaine showed that probably the place where most ticks were found was actually on legs, followed by the body, the torso, and then the various other places. But there's no place that was tick safe. So you got to look and feel everywhere.
Really. And if you have a friend, you know, enjoy your tick check adventure. Because you can't get, you know, it's hard to see. You need to use a mirror if you're by yourself or someone.
It fascinates me that over time there has been a shift in the population as far as who is having most cases of Lyme disease. So the 5 to 14-year-olds remain significantly impacted. And for a long time, it was the 45 to 64 crowd that was the second hump. In the state of Maine and gradually nationally, it's over 65 that is the other high risk for infection group. I don't think we know yet why that is. Is it that we're all just living longer? Is it that we're living longer, more actively? Or is it that we are less likely to have someone who can check with us? I don't know.
We also have a higher percentage of people over 65 in Maine. Just, our population, just sheer numbers. But I think the activity and getting someone to look at your back, that's why the shower is so important.
Shower's good.
Hard to feel. So if just a little bit of business here. If you've just tuned in, I want you to know that I'm Rhonda Fineman, and you're listening to the Healthy Options Program right here on WERU Community Radio. Our guest today is Dr. Beatrice Santier, our go-to expert on Lyme disease and related tick diseases. So now we know about what to treat our clothing with and what our bodies with, my goodness, and how to check for a tick, but let's face it, sometimes you may miss something. So in the unlikely event that you haven't been perfect, what do we do now?
Well, if you find a tick, first order of business, do not panic. Do not panic. You have time, and prompt, proper removal can help prevent an infection. Not every tick is carrying infection, so keep your wits about you. The studied and best methods have been, with fine-nosed tweezers, grab the tick as close to the skin as possible. So if you can get to the mouth parts, that's terrific. And with steady, gentle pressure, lift it straight out. Don't twist it, don't wind it up, straight out. And you might see the skin tent up a little bit. That's okay. Keep going. Steady, gentle pressure, and it will come out kind of hard.
And it makes a noise.
Well,
I do remember I did have a tick when I did have to call Dr. Santier, and I did not keep my wits about me. I called Dr. Santier immediately and said, yes, don't panic. Okay. Talk me down, as they say. But I did hear a definite thunk when, yeah. So they're really in there because they have their,
The mouth their little themselves have barbs. Like barbs on a hook, they have multiple barbs. They mean to stay in until they're finished feeding. They're being a good animal. I mean, this is an effective system for this animal for survival. And it needs a blood meal. And the way in which it takes it is it sucks a little, spits a little. And some of the stuff that it spits in is a cement-like compound that keeps it anchored. So it means not to just be casually removed. This is one you have to work at.
So you got your tweezers in there and you're pulling up.
And pull up, steady, gentle pressure. Don't give up. Just hold that steady pressure and it will come out. The other tried and true tested method is with a tick scoop. They kind of look like a measuring spoon, a measuring teaspoon with a notch carved into the front of it. The way you use that is to wedge the mouth parts of the tick into that notch. So you might be pushing down a little on the skin to make that happen. And the body of the tick into the bowl of that spoon. And then the way you do it is you just go straight across the bite site and voila, tick and spoon. So once you've done that, wash your hands, wash the bite site, wash your instrument, whichever one it was, put the tick into a container, a plastic Ziploc, with some container so that you can keep it for identification and maybe for testing. What I would like to remind folks is please do not put Vaseline. Do not try to burn the tick with that, blow a match out and touch it to the tick, because it'll, what you're told is it'll make it back out. It really won't. It really won't. And anything that you put on the tick might cause this early attached tick to regurgitate, and what it will regurgitate into that wound is the contents of its little tick stomach. And what's in that little tick stomach at the start of feeding is this bacteria, and it gradually multiplies, gets into circulation, then up into the salivary glands where it, you know, is put in as it feeds over time. And that's why we believe it takes some amount of time for the infection to be transmitted. Now, there probably, Willy Bergdorfer said, probably 2% of ticks to 5% of ticks already have that bacteria in the salivary glands when they start to feed, because they probably got dislodged from feeding on something else. So it does take less time if they already have bacteria there. And of course, this is about bacteria that causes Lyme disease and not the other infectors, which are transmitted in different amounts of times. Anaplasma is known to be transmitted in under 24 hours. Babesia is longer, usually, than that. Borrelia miyamotoid, the hard tick relapsing fever agent, is less than 24 hours. So we don't know what's in your tick. And
Powassan is what you said, 15 minutes. Very scary. Yeah.
So you want to treat the tick well. Do not annoy the tick. Do not be mean to it. Just take it out. Anything that delays your careful removal is not worth it. So don't put dish soap on it. Don't put any of those things. Tweezers or a tick scoop and take it out. If you feel that you cannot do that, call your doctor. You know, call your healthcare provider. It's okay to go with a tick and ask someone else to remove it. So
now, sometimes there is not a clean removal. There is, we hear of body parts, not yours.
Yeah, the head left in.
Yeah. So then we call that what do we call that?
We call it complicated. That's what I call right. It a complicated removal. It's really nice if it comes out a happy tick and you know that it's a short duration attachment. You know, we don't have treatment for Powassan, so we're only going to be watching for that anyway. But if it's a short duration attachment, clean removal, that's probably pretty safe. If it's not a clean removal, or you don't know how long it was attached, if there's any evidence of feeding, that is, if you don't have a perfectly flat tick, then you have to consider whether treating to prevent Lyme disease would be a good idea.
So you're saying when they get enlarged?
Yes. Well, you know, these are very small ticks. The black-legged tick is very small when it starts out. We're still in the adult tick feeding time right now. So they're about the size of a sesame seed when they start to feed, but they can enlarge significantly till they're plump as a raisin. So they can get to be quite big. The most common time to acquire Lyme disease actually is from May through the end of the summer, when the nymphal tick stage of this particular tick starts feeding. That's the size of a poppy seed when it starts to feed, but it can enlarge significantly, again, to the size of a raisin practically. So size doesn't tell you everything you need to know, but if it is not flat, like visibly flat, then it has had time to feed. And that makes it potentially a risky bite for you.
So we're getting into May through the summer. So we are looking at the height of their feeding.
Yeah.
And poppy seed. So you're looking for very, very small when you're doing your tick checks before that's why the shower and bathing, because they can wash off before they've had a chance to attach. So
the other thing that we didn't mention is you might want to take whatever clothes you've been wearing and toss them in the dryer.
Right.
High heat for 10 minutes. If you wash them first, that's okay, but that won't kill the tick. And then you need like 50 to 60 minutes of high heat to kill ticks. But there.
Well, that's important to know. And especially in more energy efficient dryers, if something's not wet, it's not going to go on. So you have to put something wet in the dryer and so wash, you know,
if wash
your clothes.
Then it just takes longer. That's the thing.
Okay, that's good to know. So now here we are with our engorged tick. So now you're saying it's engorged, and we have left the mouth in. So we saved the tick, by the way, and we'll talk about where to send it, because we do want to definitely talk about testing. And we'll have all of this, by the way, on the archives, and it'll be all there, so you can look up all the places and all the information. And hopefully we can get something that'll show a little video of the removal. We'll see if we can do that. But anyway, so here we are with a compromised tick removal. Compromised. Yeah. Now what?
Well, you know, if the mouth parts are left behind, honestly, the mouth parts themselves are of less concern than the fact that the tick broke. Because if the tick broke, that means that tick fluids can have gotten into the wound. So it can make it a more risky wound. The mouth parts themselves are going to act like a splinter. They're either going to fester or they're not. Now, I like to get them out, but, you know, it may be a challenge to do it. You may have to carefully, again, with your tweezers, really work at the resulting mouth parts, or talk to your healthcare provider. Either way, you probably want to let your healthcare provider know that this has happened, that you've had this close encounter with a tick, because it is possible that using antibiotics preventively at this time, within the first 48 hours, there's one study that says 72, but I think 48 hours is probably more prudent. You can take antibiotics to prevent infection. We have only got data on this concerning Lyme disease, and the data we have is limited. So truly limited. A lot of folks who cite the data talk about European studies that have been done. And what I have to tell you is that doesn't apply, because most of the studies are using as the information about Lyme disease developing the development of a rash. The European species of Borrelia that usually causes a rash is not likely to spread. So any study that gives us information about, you know, developing a rash and whether you would therefore get Lyme disease from Europe is not informative for the U.S.
So if you're in Europe, our species spreads, you mean through the body, and the European doesn't. Isn't that interesting?
Right. I mean, there are species in Europe that do.
Of course.
But the one most likely to cause a rash doesn't. So their studies don't tell us what we need to know. So using American studies, there's really only been one that tried a single dose of doxycycline at the time within 72 hours of tick attachment. And it showed that you were less likely to develop a rash at the site of the tick bite. The study was flawed in ways that I think we don't have enough time to really discuss. But in the smallest way, it didn't go long enough to see if people developed other symptoms of Lyme disease. And some of the negative consequences of a single dose are that if you don't completely cure the infection, you can go on to be ill, but antibiotics early can cause your body to turn off its antibody production. So now when you show up a month or 6 weeks later and you're sick and we do the blood test, you may not test positive and still have the disease. And actually, that outcome was found to occur in that study. So single dose doxy is very commonly used, but the healthcare providers using it need to know the caveats. And you do not get to stop thinking about later symptoms. You have to mark it on your calendar. Whether you get an antibiotic or not, you've got to keep track of symptoms that you might develop. And hopefully your provider will be equally concerned. if you develop symptoms as a result.
So when you were talking about doing antibiotics, then you're talking about 10 days, 3 weeks, to what's required? I know we see all those numbers out in the literature.
Well, you know, what's really hard, Rhonda, is that the truth is we do not know how much antibiotic is necessary to prevent a case of Lyme disease. We know there were three studies done using 10 days of antibiotics, but at the time that those studies were done, the infection rate among the ticks was low enough so that there weren't enough people to for that to reach statistical significance. That said, no one in the treatment group developed Lyme disease, and they followed for a much longer time, and 6 cases in the placebo group. It did not reach statistical significance. So can we say that that works? Maybe. We don't know. The single dose study, again, didn't follow out past 6 weeks. So it claimed 87% efficacy, but there are some analyses that suggest maybe it's 50%. Well, that's not bad. That's not bad. So is it a day? Is it one dose? Is it 3 days? Is it 5 days? Is it 10 days? Is it 20 days? The real bottom line is we don't know.
So, well, there are two things.
Yeah.
One is that if you have a clinical diagnosis, a rash, or you really are ill, you have to treat. And if you feel like it could be anaplasmosis, you have to treat. And that would be a full course in the Western world, maybe the 3 weeks of doxycycline. Now, I know
the data we have is 3 weeks of doxycycline for Lyme disease is most efficacious.
Right. Now, I do know that there are other herbal components that can actually help. There are different herbs that are antibiotic-like, right. That wouldn't be just the one dose of, and the one dose, when they say doxy, they're 2 pills in the one dose. But so it's okay to say no to that if you want your body to work, to get your antibodies up, and then I'll do the herbs at that point, or if it's a very obvious clinical. You know, I haven't heard this in a long time, but I did just hear of somebody who called a walk-in clinic in this area and got the come in. Oh, we'll just wait and see. Come in if. And wow, that's like ancient history of medical awareness, would you say? Yeah,
I think we know that roughly 50% of the black-legged ticks that are being studied. Close to 50%, it varies year to year, but about 50% have infection. So, I mean, you know, it's a crapshoot at that point.
Yeah.
I think that if you have a very short duration attachment, less than 12 hours, and you know it, and it's a very clean removal, and you're a very careful person, you could make an argument for wait and see. But that is not prevention. That's early recognition. And you have to know that. The thing that concerns me a lot is when people go with their rash already developed. Now, you can get kind of like a pinky finger, tip of your finger sized rash at the site of a tick bite immediately. And it might get a little bit bigger, but it should be gone in about 24 hours. Anything beyond that time, I'm always concerned that is now erythema migrans. We do not treat erythema migrans with a single dose doxy. If you erythema migrans,
that is
a rash of Lyme disease,
that is Lyme
disease and needs full treatment.
By the way, if you just tuned in, this is Rhonda Feynman. I'm the host of the Healthy Options program that you're listening to right here on WERU Community Radio. We're speaking with Dr. Beatrice Santier about ticks, tick-borne disease, prevention, and good guidelines for treatment here. There are herbal things one can do. It seems if you have Lyme disease can also get encapsulated, right? So, I mean, the bacteria can actually hide. So if you are catching it early, then you can reduce the idea of long-term Lyme. What does that mean?
Yeah, you know, we know that untreated, about 60% of people with early Lyme will go on to develop arthritis. That, you know, that's, we have good data about that. 15 to 30% will go on to develop neurologic kinds of symptoms. And even well-treated, one study called ideally treated early disease, it is something like 15 to 20% develop later symptoms that have, they've been called post-treatment Lyme disease. I call it persistent symptoms after treatment. Now, if you have immediately after treatment persistent symptoms, we ought to treat you again. Because in the earliest studies, that's what they did. They would treat for 3 weeks with an antibiotic. And if people were not better, they'd treat them again. And son of a gun, if people didn't get better. So if it's immediate, let's treat you again. If it's more stuttering and we identify it later, that becomes much more challenging to figure out. But it can be figured out to some extent. And I'm excited that long COVID and chronic fatigue syndrome and long Epstein-Barr virus and now long Lyme are getting attention at the federal level, and certainly have long had attention from practicing clinicians. That's harder to know what to do. Some people probably do have persisting infection, and there's evidence in the literature for this. Some people may have an inflammatory response that needs to be addressed and quieted so that they can return to their normal life. Some people might have an immune problem that needs to be addressed. Some people have other infections that have taken advantage of your weakened condition and that need to be addressed. And having one of these things does not preclude having others of these things. Mm. So that's more complicated. And that's why although we could talk for a long time about that, I think prevention and early recognition help to keep us away from the more challenging but still treatable long kinds of problems.
Well, I do know that for some clinicians doing treating long-term Lyme disease and these co-infections, which are the things that are infections that we talked about, they're using different kinds of antibiotics too, and their combinations. We don't need to get into that. That's another conversation. But the idea is that you would need to go to someone who has been studying this and really understands what that is. And then again, there are Lyme literate doctors, and also there are herbal ways of doing this, homeopathic, long-term homeopathic protocols that have been effective for, you know, and it really every individual is unique and can respond and have different needs about what's going to work for them.
Right. I think you make a great point. Do what works. And sometimes what works has to be determined for you specifically. Every single case is its own individual experience of this. And so it needs to be looked at person by person in a patient-centered, person-specific way so that we can determine how best to help.
So two things. One is you could get a tick bite, and again, we're saving the tick, so we will talk about where to send it. And but also, you can not, maybe you don't get sick right away. How
that
long?
Excellent point.
So that's, you know, that, wow, like, I don't know, 7 months later, all of a sudden I have these weird things. Do I even remember that I got a tick bite back in March, you know, or May 15th or, yeah. So
that is another thing.
Or February.
Yeah, exactly. Year round activity now. We know from the early studies that latency, that is the delay between an actual time of infection and development of symptoms, was looked at in a whole crowd of folks who had neurologic impact, so encephalopathy, trouble thinking, brain fog, memory issues, up to 18 months or even years later before they actually developed the symptoms of the disease. Some of that might be that your immune system is just really, really good. And so you can tamp it down for a long time, and then something occurs that draws your immune system's energy off. You know, maybe that car accident, maybe a different diagnosis of another health problem.
Right.
It just shows its ugly head, and that can be really hard to figure out, because testing is what we wish would work every time, but the testing is not perfectly reliable. In early disease, you don't develop an antibody response. Most of what we're testing is an antibody response. You don't develop that for 2 to 8 weeks, 6, 2, 4, 6, 8 weeks, sometime out there. So in early disease, it's not helpful. There's no point in getting a test. You can't do anything with it. In late disease, it's better for arthritis than it is for, say, neurologic disease. It's just better. It identifies it better. And in persistent disease, we really don't know what to do with the testing, because you can still be sick and your antibody response can wane, or you can be well and you can have persistent antibodies. What do we do with that? So it's challenging to identify.
And I know we're really coming to the end. We have about a minute, a couple of minutes. No, I'm getting the right number here. So good. We can ask us. It's good to have a good co-producer. But what we were talking earlier about something about women and men having different reactions for some reason or treatment.
Yeah, it's really kind of interesting. There have been a few studies and a few ways of looking at this, and apparently, now this is in people with definite Lyme disease, women who were identified by that 5 centimeter or greater erythema migrans rash, so tended to have rashes that were about 2 centimeters smaller than those in males. Okay, so does that, okay. We'll do that. Tended to have less of a reaction on one of the tests called the ELISA test. Tended to have fewer reactions on the immunoblot IgG. And when you kind of put all that together and couple it with, well, men tend to have a lot more arthritis than women. Well, is that because women don't have the test reactions necessary to get their arthritis diagnosed? Women, we see a male predominance even in early Lyme. Is that because women don't meet that 5 centimeters for diagnosis? We don't know. These are new questions. So.
Wow. Well, we're going to have to leave it there for our next show. I cannot believe it. We'll have all of the information about where to get testing in Maine. What is that? The Orono, up the lab in Orono. Real quick, Orono. Very quick.
Yeah. UMaine Cooperative Extension Tick Lab. You can find that right online. $20. They'll test for everything for free. They'll identify it.
Okay. There we go. Wow. So much more to say. Thank you. Our guest today on Healthy Options has been Dr. Beatrice Santier. Again, thank you for being with us again on Healthy Options. It's always good to speak with you. You can find links to the show and to other information that was mentioned, as well as all the previous interviews we've done with Dr. Santier, in the Healthy Options archives of the Public Affairs section at weru.org. And please get the WERU app, and you can listen to all the Healthy Options there. Thanks to Joel Mann, Amy Brown, WERU engineer, support at WERU. I'm going too fast. And to Petra Hall for production assistance. And as always, thanks to all of our WERU listeners and supporters. This is Rhonda Feynman wishing you the best in health.